Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keen On, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. A couple of weeks ago, Pew Research Center ran an interesting poll about who likes authoritarianism. What countries in the world are most attracted to authoritarian leaders, some more than others? The poll was intriguing, suggested that quote unquote middle income countries like India and Indonesia are more attracted to authoritarianism than wealthier countries. Poorer countries also like Kenya, South Africa, Nigeria, Mexico are also attracted. When it comes to high-income countries, US polled reasonably high at 32% of people who are sympathetic to the idea of a strong leader or a military leader, which would be a good way of governing the country. But the US wasn't that different from other countries. Canada was at 27%, the UK at 37%. I'm particularly interested in this poll in the context of my guest today. Jacob Heilbrun has a new book out. It's quite a hit already. America Last, not of course America First, The Right's Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators, which is a book about a 100-year love affair between, at least according to Heilbrun, American conservatives and foreign leaders. Jacob is joining us from his basement in Washington, D.C., full of expensive hi-fi gear. Jacob, what do you make of that Pew poll? I assume you looked at it.
It's quite heartening, and it doesn't really surprise me. I have been fairly optimistic that Trump's message is not a winning one, that it appeals to an ardent base that sees him as a quasi-religious savior, but that the Republican Party, in embracing Trump, is headed for electoral disaster this fall. Now, this might sound as though it repudiates my book thesis, but I don't think it does. In my book, I trace what I see as a tradition on the right, not the sole tradition. And in the book, I try to explain how a segment of the right has militantly pushed for a strong man and for a fortress America over the past 100 years, and that this impulse has waxed and waned, but that it has never been the dominant one in the GOP until the ascension of Donald Trump.
Jacob, I don't think the Pew people broke it down in terms of parties, but do you think that there were a higher, would you guess, are a higher proportion of Republicans who are more sympathetic to authoritarianism than Democrats in America? Or would it break down according to age or gender?
I think if you look at the Trump phenomenon, you look at the rally that he was just held in Dayton, Ohio, where he declared that there could be a bloodbath in the United States if he were not to be reelected, with conservatives saying he really was talking about the auto industry. But you look at the other aspects of that rally, calling the J6 prisoners hostages, singing the national anthem on their behalf, referring to asylum seekers as not being people. I think it's pretty clear that the Trump base has an affinity for the strongman, and that Trump exemplifies that. And, you know, he was caught on the hot mic also saying about Kim Jong-un that when he talks, people sit up straight. And Trump said, that's what I want. I don't think there's any mystery about this. Yes, I think that there is a strange predilection right now on the right for the strongman. Doesn't mean that there hasn't been one in the past on the left.
We'll talk about that. You forced me to sit up straight, Jacob, after after all that. I don't want to turn this into another Trump conversation, but when it comes to him, I think you and I, we've talked about this before, might differ slightly. He seems to me to be a television personality playing the role of a strong man. And I'm not even convinced that he thinks of himself as a strong man. Is there any truth to that? I mean, he's not in the Franco Mussolini Kaiser Wilhelm II mode, is he, in terms of a man who actually thinks he's a strong man, a military leader?
Why not? If you look at Hitler, and there's a new book out by Peter Pomerantsev.
Yeah, who's been on the show before.
Now, his argument, which is intriguing, he lands on the side of Hitler being, to some extent, an actor, that fascism is based on both sides playing out a role, and that the audience enjoys the dispensation that the strong man gives them to act out their fantasies, and that even Hitler was something of an actor up there playing a role that catered to his audience. So, you know, the more you look at Trump, the more I start to wonder if he really isn't a megalomaniac who conceives of himself as someone who has the right recipe for the United States, that the United States has been on the wrong path and that he's the man to set it aright. And in this context, I would look at the 1990 interview he did in Playboy, where he denounced Mikhail Gorbachev for allowing the Soviet Union to collapse. He said he didn't use a firm enough hand, and he lauded the Chinese for being what he called vicious, horribly vicious, at Tiananmen Square. So Trump has never really made any bones about where his sympathies lie.
Well, let's go back to the thesis in your book. As I said, I don't want to turn this into another discussion on Trump, although I'm sure we'll come back to him. You argue that over the last 100 years, the American right, conservatives, presumably mostly within the Republican Party, have had a century-long romance with foreign dictators. As you suggested in the beginning, doesn't imply marriage. Often we enjoy a romance before we settle down with our mate. But what is this romance? And is it different from the left? And is it different from the American right in the 19th century?
It has its own specific characteristics, but it is not different from the left in that it looks to foreign societies as a model for the United States. And in the book, I show how H.L. Mencken and other American conservatives were besotted with Prussian authoritarianism and Kaiser Wilhelm II. And that Mencken, for example, argued in a piece that he wrote for The Atlantic that the United States would be better off if it were conquered by Prussia, that it was a higher order society. It was a true aristocracy. It exemplified a better culture than the ragtag American democracy, than the decadence that you would find here. So in that sense, the right is similar to the left. You look at Lincoln Steffens or George Bernard Shaw, they idealized Stalin's Soviet Union at the moment of its worst excesses, the purges during the 1930s, the show trials. They saw the Soviet Union as a model for the West. And then it went into successive regimes. It included Mao's China, Fidel Castro's Cuba, Ho Chi Minh's Vietnam, were all seen as these paradises that the United States could imitate. But what I try to show in the book is that the right has its own analog with its own specific grievances, that it goes from Kaiser Wilhelm to Mussolini to Hitler to Franco during the Cold War.
Yeah, no, let's talk about Wilhelm II, the Kaiser of Germany. He certainly wasn't the most populist of figure. He was a upright man, military man. What was it about Kaiser Wilhelm II in the pre-First World War age that seduced H.L. Mencken?
Well, Mencken saw Prussia and the Kaiser as figures that embodied what a true aristocracy could accomplish, and that German culture was superior to American culture. And he admired the Prussian bureaucracy. He admired the veneration for order in Germany. He saw the Kaiser as a great monarch. He believed that Germany had been encircled by the Western powers, by Great Britain and France. And he saw, above all, he thought that because the Kaiser Wilhelm was opposed to democracy, he saw him as an authoritarian leader who was worthy of emulation in the United States. Driving all of this, in a sense, is an anti-Enlightenment, anti-liberal, and in modern terms, anti-democratic impulse.
What about the isolationism? I mean, obviously today, support for Germany in the First World War is hard to imagine outside, not including the Second World War. But at the time, I mean, that was a legitimate argument, I guess, amongst conservatives who certainly wanted to keep America out of the First World War. Mencken was from Baltimore. Is there a racial element there, and do you think, in Mencken's argument, given the dominance of race in American history, was this embrace of Wilhelm II another Southern strategy?
There is certainly an element of it, because Mencken was, of course, himself a racist and an anti-Semite, which, by the way, Kaiser Wilhelm II was as well. And the Kaiser's statements about Jews and Africa, where the Germans engaged in colonization projects, they were late to the game. His statements were quite venomous. And after World War I, the Kaiser said that Jews should be gassed to death for having cost Germany victory in World War I. So yes, I think there was definitely a racial element to the admiration for Germans and Kaiser Wilhelm.
I mean, Mencken was also an incredibly talented writer. And he was, in his own way, an anti-authoritarian writer, certainly an irreverent writer. How do you square that?
It is interesting, because Mencken was a libertarian, and I don't think he ever, and I put this bluntly in the book, I don't think he ever reconciled the worship of the autocratic Prussian bureaucracy with his own views. And Walter Lippmann, the famous journalist, pointed this out at the time. He said, this is pure romanticism on Mencken's part. In a country like Germany, he wouldn't be free to write whatever he pleases.
What about an alternative conservative tradition in terms of dealing with men like Kaiser Wilhelm II? Would you find that with someone like Teddy Roosevelt before the First World War?
Definitely. Roosevelt is more of an internationalist and, in many ways, a more authentic realist, because he was interested in power politics. He wanted to increase and maximize America's influence abroad. And he was a vehement critic of Kaiser Wilhelm. Of course, Roosevelt was never able to recapture the presidency and lost to Woodrow Wilson when he campaigned for the presidency in 1912. But the Roosevelt tradition, actually, you could argue that that is, you know, the mugwump, the more liberal internationalist tradition in the GOP, that is the counterweight to this isolationist libertarian tradition that I chronicle in the book.
This isolationist libertarian tradition, as you said, that you chronicle in the book, climaxed, if that's the right word, obviously in the 1930s during the Great Depression. How did Republican presidents like Harding and particularly Coolidge and Hoover fit into your thesis? I'm guessing that these weren't men particularly intrigued by European dictators like Kaiser Wilhelm II or Mussolini.
No, I point more, though Harding did jump into the whole debate over a rising tide of color in the United States that I talk about in a speech in Alabama. There was a book in 1920 I focused on a eugenicist named Lothrop Stoddard, who was an admirer of both Mussolini and Hitler, and who was quoted extensively by Harding. And Stoddard's argument was that the United States needed to should not promote democracy abroad and should be focusing on stopping immigration into the United States from Asia and Africa, that we had lost the finest flower of white men in World War I and could not, it would be race suicide to indulge in a repetition of that. And he in the 1930s, he was a prominent defender of both Mussolini and Hitler. Coolidge and Harding, no. I don't think that they really...
Certainly not Hoover, I'm guessing, as an internationalist.
However, with Herbert Hoover, things really do hot up because he met with Hitler in 1938 in March on the eve of the Anschluss or annexation of Austria and praised Nazi inroads into Eastern Europe and Central Europe, arguing that the Nazis would be able to maintain order. And Hoover explicitly denounced Franklin Roosevelt at the 1940 Republican Convention in Philadelphia, saying that the Roosevelt administration should stop criticizing Nazi officials and Nazism because it was simply leading towards war.
Your observations about Kaiser Wilhelm were very interesting to me. I hadn't read or heard about those before, but of course, we're all familiar with America's flirtation with fascism or authoritarianism in Europe in the 1930s as a consequence of the Great Depression, of Lindbergh and American isolationism. What's your take on the depths of this in the 1930s? Some people might argue that America actually emerged from the 1930s a stronger democracy than perhaps any other democracy in the world.
It did indeed, but it was a close run. And the Roosevelt administration, as I point out in the book, explicitly condemned a number of politicians, businessmen, and journalists as fascists who posed a dire threat to American democracy. Roosevelt's Attorney General Robert Jackson, for example, delivered a speech in 1940 in Boston called Democracy Under Fire. And he singled out figures like Merwin Hart, a prominent and anti-Semitic businessman in New York who was a fervent champion of Francisco Franco. So, and they also went at hammer and tongs after Charles Lindbergh, the famous aviator. It was not some academic debate. These figures managed to stymie aid to Great Britain and preach defeatism and argue that we should ally ourselves with the Nazis rather than with Democratic Great Britain, much in the way that you hear contemporary figures in the Republican Party argue that Ukraine is doomed and that we should not extend it any further financial or military aid.
Jacob, how much could we fit this into a general reaction against modernity? There was the Scopes trial, of course, of 1924, a lot of anti-scientific thought, hostility, as we've already talked to, towards Jews and particularly African Americans. To what extent is this embrace of the strong leader in the 1920s and 30s, a rejection of modernity?
Well, it's a mixed bag. A friend of mine named Jeffrey Herf, who's a historian, wrote a book called Reactionary Modernism, in which he shows how the Nazis both were reactionaries, but also embraced technology. So there was a perception in the 1930s that both Mussolini and Hitler were the avant-garde, that they had in fact figured out a solution to the Great Depression and to the problems of democracy that had eluded countries like the United States or Great Britain.
And this convinced many creatives, Ezra Pound, for example. I mean, there were many highly talented creative people who were also seduced by this, what seems now to be pretty much nonsense.
It was nonsense, and there were people saying it at the time, But, you know, there is sort of an attraction among some intellectuals to violence. And I talked about that in the beginning of my book, George Orwell in 1984, which was written after World War II, but talks about the seductiveness for the intellectual of having the whip hand on history. And that is a phenomenon that we've witnessed both on the left and the right.
What about, Jacob, the role of religion here? Of course, the Catholic Church, or certain extremists within the Catholic Church in the 1930s, were associated with isolationism and particularly hostility to Jews. On the other hand, the KKK seems, at least in the 1920s, as overtly hostile to Catholics as they were to Jews or Blacks. So is there a connection between organized religion and this flirtation with authoritarianism in America in the 30s?
There was in the among Catholics, in the ardent embrace of Franco, which is really a perversion of the Christian doctrine. But this idea that you could return to what's called throne and altar politics, that you would have a fusion of church and state. And that's what attracted Catholics in the 1930s, including Father Coughlin. And then in the 1950s, William F. Buckley and his brother-in-law, L. Brent Pozell, were also saw this return to medieval mores and ways as quite seductive. And we see it again today.
Yeah, we definitely. A lot of these conservative, these rather fashionable conservative writers have fallen back in love with the medieval world.
This candidate in North Carolina, Mark Robinson, for governor, just announced that he sees absolutely no distinction between church and state. He's never found it in the writings of the founding fathers. It's all nonsense. We need to dispense with it. And then you have the integralist intellectuals. You have Senator J.D. Vance, who apparently is quite sympathetic.
And Patrick Deneen, his work seems to suggest eliminating the distinction between church and state. Interesting stuff. We are talking with Jacob Heilbrun, the author of America Last. He doesn't want America to go last, but he has written a very important and interesting book, The Right's Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. One publication that definitely has not been seduced by authoritarianism is Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics put out by the estimable my friend, whose name I'm forgetting now. Can you remind me, Jacob, who run Leon Weaseltier, wonderful editor. And they help us bring high quality guests like Jacob Heilbrun. I'm going to run a short feature on Liberties and then we'll be back. And I want to talk about this romance that continued amazingly enough after the Second World War, even after the defeat of fascism in Europe. So we'll be back in a second. Don't go away, anyone. Don't get seduced by any authoritarian leaders.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We are speaking with Jacob Heilbrun, the author of America Last, The Right Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. One would have assumed, Jacob, that the Second World War would have ended that romance. The defeat of Hitler, the defeat of Mussolini, the defeat of authoritarianism in Europe and indeed in Japan. But you seem to suggest in your book, In America Last, that that wasn't the case. What happened?
Well, the assumption would be wrong because there was actually an efflorescence of anti-Semitism and the first stirrings of what would become known as Holocaust denial on the right. I look at a variety of figures, such as Henry Regnery, who founded an influential publishing press and had himself studied in Nazi Germany in 1934 and saw nothing amiss, even in his memoirs decades later, about what was taking place in Germany, and began in the late 40s, early 50s, his publishing press by publishing a variety of books that argued that Israel shouldn't have been established and that the United States had perpetrated war crimes that were as bad, if not worse, than those carried out by the Nazis. And I also focused on Senator Joe McCarthy, who first rose to prominence by attacking the War Department's prosecution of Nazi soldiers and SS members who had massacred American soldiers in 1944 at Malmedy, Belgium. And McCarthy argued that Jewish lawyers in the War Department, intent on vengeance, were the true persecutors, that they had set up and framed these innocent Nazi soldiers.
So are you suggesting, you bringing out McCarthy is, of course, still an incredibly controversial figure, someone actually tied to Joe Kennedy. Are you suggesting that this romance with foreign dictators, at least in your view, this right century-long romance, got reconfigured in the language of the Cold War and anti-communism?
Oh, definitely. But it still had traces of the past, because the right moved largely on from Hitler by the time that William F. Buckley establishes the National Review. But then the Franco worship remains. Portugal's Salazar is a hero. And I look closely at South Africa.
When you say a hero, well, I mean, William F. Buckley has a reasonably credible reputation intellectually. Are you suggesting that men like Buckley fell in love with Salazar or Franco?
Sure. I mean, there's no question. There was the hero worship of these men. And the National Review actually published a piece by Salazar himself. And Buckley, in 1957, wrote the National Review op-ed explaining why the Negro, as they put it, should not be given the vote, and went on to pen effusive pieces about why apartheid South Africa was a good thing.
And this was paralleled on the left by the left's embrace of Castro and some other post-colonial leaders. Was it different?
I think the difference is the racial element. That the left had this idealistic vision that you could create a workers' paradise, whereas these conservatives, especially in defending apartheid, which was essentially based on Nazi ideology to a large
extent. Right, the left wanted to kill whites, the right wanted to kill Jews and blacks, right?
Well,
I'm joking, but...
It's an episode that has not been, well, I try to rectify it, but has not been sufficiently appreciated, I think, is that the right was endorsing a Nazi-like regime in the form of South Africa.
And what about, I don't know if South Africa was racist and segregationist, more colonial than fascist. What about the right's embrace of Latin America conservative neo-fascists like Perón and Pinochet and other leaders in Latin America? I'm guessing that there was a romance there too, but then the economists took it up as well, the Chicago School and their embrace of Pinochet in their economics. How did this connect with the increasing fashion for free market theory of Friedman and the rest of the University of Chicago School?
Well, there was definitely, I think they got seduced as well. I mean, they overlooked the human rights abuses and reckoned that the economic progress that Pinochet was bringing to Chile justified whatever stern measures the regime needed to take. What I found interesting with Buckley and conservatives with Chile is that they didn't simply defend it as a pawn in the Cold War to oppose the Soviet Union, but they actually actively admired and again worshipped Pinochet as a military leader, with Buckley penning one column in which he actually describes Pinochet's physique and his regal manner, as he put it.
So does your thesis suggest that we shouldn't actually, we talked about Trump earlier, of course, and I don't want to turn this, just as I said earlier, into a Trump conversation, but that we shouldn't be surprised, not just with Trump, but with men like Steve Bannon, and I'm guessing that Bannon really fits centrally into your thesis, that the right has always been in love with authoritarians. So Bannon's love affair with Orban, Trump's fetish with Putin, we shouldn't really be surprised with this.
No, we shouldn't. It is the culmination of this quixotic tradition. And because of the collapse of the Republican Party after the Iraq War, it became possible for someone like Donald Trump to implement these paleo-conservative ideas that had been circulating for about 100 years. Absent the Iraq War, it's hard for me to imagine that they would have been able to control the commanding heights as they do now.
We did a show a couple of years ago with Ruth Ben-Ghia, and she teaches at NYU. She has a very influential book on male authoritarianism. She focuses actually on Mussolini here. She's an Italian historian, amongst other things. We haven't talked, Jacob, about gender, but how central is the male in this, in terms of American men and their cult of other strong men, and perhaps seeing some of this at least as a reaction against feminism?
Yes, that's another theme that pops up actually with Mussolini. I looked at the Warren Harding's ambassador to Rome, Richard Washburn Child, who was first impressed by the strenuous life that Theodore Roosevelt exemplified. And then he became smitten with Mussolini as a real man. And in contrast to the decadence of the flapper age, and he wrote numerous articles in the Saturday Evening Post praising the return to family values in Italy. And Mussolini himself delivered a speech in 1927 saying that he was going to institute a new tax to give the demographic lash to bachelors, that Italy needed to bump up its birth rate to at least 50 million or 60 million by 1950. So this hypermasculinity that we see in conservatism was already there in the 1920s.
What about the role of women in contemporary conservatism? Giorgia Meloni is the new prime minister of Italy, another controversial woman with a complicated relationship with Mussolini, although she's got reasonably decent press. Mrs. Thatcher, of course, was also a hero amongst conservatives, although I'm not sure she was either authoritarian or certainly against Jews. How does this fit in with the fact that there are women both in and out of politics who are actually attracted with strong leadership? And can one be a strong leader and also be a Democrat?
You can be a Democrat, because what these strong leaders really oppose is the rule of law. And they like having popularity. Trump likes elections if he thinks he can win them. I don't think his beef is so much with democracy as the rule of law. For the women, one of the things that surprised me in researching this book was how many women were attracted to the strong man. And that, I looked at Elizabeth.
Why were you surprised? It doesn't surprise me.
Well, I didn't, you know, I was thinking, it just didn't occur to me that it would be, there was the mother's movement in the 1930s in the United States. There was Elizabeth Dilling. There were a variety of figures.
How does Phyllis Schlafly fit into this? Is she part of this infatuation with foreign dictators?
No, I didn't. At least I didn't come across it. Unless it's a lacuna in my research, but I don't think so. I was looking at specific leaders abroad, and someone like Elizabeth Dilling admired both Franco, and she was known as the female Führer in Germany itself. And then I looked at Jean Kirkpatrick and her.
Was Kirkpatrick, do you see her as part of this? I mean, she was
I do.
Small D Democrat, wasn't she?
For a while, but she did definitely shifted to the right, and she supported the Argentines when they invaded the Falkland Islands quite vehemently against the rest of the...
Against Mrs. Thatcher.
Yes. And she, you know, she was, her whole theory was that we should support right-wing dictatorships, that they were a good thing.
What about the issue of sexuality as well? I mean, some of the Mussolini and Hitler worship seem homoerotic, to put it mildly. How does that fit in, particularly in America, where the issue of sexuality and gender has transformed the country over the last 50 years and been very controversial?
Well, I don't think that it was simply homoerotic. I mean, you had that element in Nazism, especially with the SA, which was led by Ernst Röhm.
Who were purged, of course. And
yes.
But he was a long knife.
You know, pretty much from the outset. And controlled, you know, millions of followers before he was terminated in 1934. There was also female adulation. There is a book in Germany comprised of the letters that were sent to Hitler by worshipful females. So once again, you see that these leaders did exercise a kind of sexual attraction.
Yeah, I was at the Nazi Museum in Munich earlier this year, and there was a photo of Hitler, young Hitler, in very, very tight shorts. He wouldn't have been out of place in the Castro district of San Francisco, down just close to where I live. Finally, Jacob.
I would say that Hitler was too much of a prude to, I don't see him going down that road. I mean, he clearly had huge sexual hangups.
Well, to put it mildly. Finally, Jacob, your thesis is controversial. I don't think everyone will agree, but there's certainly an argument to be made about this right century-long romance with foreign dictators. Should, in your view, men like Trump and Bannon, should they simply be thrown out of the party? Should there be a place for these types of people in one of the two dominant parties in American democracy?
Well, it's not my job to advise whether someone should be purged or not.
What I said purged, I said thrown out.
Well, no, I think the party has failed to police itself. You do need some taboos in society, and there has to be a barrier. This is the lesson of the Nazi era. There has to be a barrier between mainstream conservatism and the radical right. When you let the radical right infect conservatism, then you're going down a very, very slippery slope.
And finally, Jacob, where are we in March 2024? It seems reasonably likely that Donald Trump will be elected as president in November of 2024, in 6 months' time. If he is indeed elected, you brought up his speech in Dayton earlier about all the blood that will be shed if he doesn't win the election. If he is elected, what's your take on whether he is intellectually disciplined enough to actually begin to dismantle American democracy and really set himself up as a strong man rather than just an actor playing a strong man?
That's the big question. And I know you're a skeptic. And there was a very good piece by Sam Adler Bell in the New York Times recently arguing that, in fact, Trump is too erratic and undisciplined to be able to execute the plans that the Heritage Foundation has devised, that he is the Sun King, a willful and capricious leader who will simply dump overboard anything that he perceives as interfering with his personal power or irrelevant or not popular. So there is that case. The counterweight is that Trump has enablers around him. And if he allows them to proceed, such as Stephen Miller as White House Chief of Staff, Michael Flynn as Secretary of Defense, Richard Grenell as Secretary of State, these are people who have large ambitions. So does J.D. Vance. There was an article in Politico saying that he regards MAGA as too timorous and wants an even more radical version of conservatism to flourish in the Republican Party. So I would simply say that if Trump were to become president with his vows of retribution, and he looks like he's not even able to come up with the bond, the $500 million. This is a man with his back to the wall. If he were to become president, all bets would be off.